So, I mean, I think we're touched. There's so much here. I think we should stop and start checking in with our cohort and seeing if people are following their questions, if there are if they're.
Absolutely. There are a couple questions, I believe. Sadia?
Hi, yeah, thank you. Hi, everyone. How's it going? Sorry for this question. It's a bit elementary, but I'm very curious. I'm curious if there are any like positive neurobiological effects of lengthening an inhale, or if a long inhale is just a precondition for a long exhale, which is the real meat of the thing.
Your question is actually an excellent question. And that is, breathing technologies can be used to change state. Not all states need to be calm states. Some states, you want them as being energetic for exuberance and enthusiasm. So people who are very well trained in breathing technologies will show you how to get tremendous power and energy through the inhalation, and how to shorten the exhalation for the expression of that that energy. So we have to be very careful about thinking about things as being good or bad. From the polyvagal perspective, we see things as having adaptive function. So having energy and strength has adaptive function, but it may not work well if I want to be sitting still in my office or talking with someone who's very close to me. I might want to have cues of accessibility and calmness. So we have these different parameters or different objectives.
Yeah, it makes sense. I ask because I'm a yoga practitioner and a teacher, and I discovered, practice for so long that I was introduced to the Krishnamacharya lineage, which was very breath-based. And discovered that being able to like find more capacity for a breath in changed everything. Changed everything.
So if you increase the capacity of breath in, you can extend the duration of breath out. Thank you.
Thanks.
Are there other questions, Krishama?
There is a general discussion around the immobilization, the immobilizing or mobilizing without fear. Do you care to expand on that a bit?
In my world, immobilization without fear is when you have moments of intimacy. And that does not mean sex. It means moments in where you share the mo you basically are sharing that moment. And we all have experienced those. It's when two people in proximity, they just almost function like one. They're sharing the moment. It could be looking at something or smelling something or just holding each other. Those moments, like you watch a baby and the mother, when they're having that shared moments of intimacy, there's no defensive, no fiber in their body is in a state of defense. So you see the body's conforming, like a baby conforming to the mother, but the mother also conforming to the baby.
Right. So I guess someone's asking, is it Gemma, to define a little bit what we mean by immobilization.
I basically use that word to talk about movement of the body, muscle tone. So you can have immobilization. So when we use the word freeze, which is commonly used in the trauma world, freeze requires muscle tone. And if it requires muscle tone, it's requiring some of the sympathetic nervous system, although it is part of a shutting down response. So it's a hybrid. So mobilization gets deconstructed in my world as muscle tone. How much metabolic demand is my are my muscles requiring?
So immobilization then is sort of like a relaxation or stillness or
Well, the immobilization without fear has this capacity of stillness. But immobilization as a defense one is not psychological stillness, it's you're gone. So the operation is operationally in both cases, the person's not moving, but neurophysiologically it's different. And different experiences on multiple levels. And it's as different as saying, I'm giving you a hug versus why are you restraining me? So it's the same action. It really has to do with the accessibility of the two people to each other. And so mobilization, I had to qualify that, or immobilization, as immobilization without fear. And then we have mobilization without fear as well. And we call that play or dance. Which, you know, we're moving. But what makes it without fear? Well, because the social engagement system is involved in play, our voice, our facial expressions, and our gestures. So play becomes this hybrid between that sympathetic system needed for mobilization and the social engagement system needed to cue the body or both people that this is a safe experience, a safe environment.
So that's that. I have heard people say that that's somehow specifically related to vasopressin activity chemically. Is that?
We'll have to, for these types of questions, I really have to defer to Sue, who is watching the town hall, or will be watching it. But a vasopressin is more complicated than just considered a mobilization fight flight, because it's also related to selectivity and pair bonding. So the point I think is that pair bonding is, in a sense, a double-edged understanding. It doesn't make you want to bond with everyone. You become selective, and when you become selective, you become very protective or defensive of that which whom or whom that you are pair bonded with.
Okay. So to go back to the question of immobilization, so I think in terms of language that Reza Menachem was using, he was talking about settling.
Yeah.
Or stillness is another way to think about it. Immobilization is like a technical, you know, a neuroscientifically technical term. But if you think about that as fearless stillness or fearless presence.
Look at it at multiple levels. No, what he's talking about is what I'm calling immobilization without fear, the appreciation of stillness. But remember, there are people that if they start to experience stillness, they jump up and run away, because immobilization to them, the lack of that movement, is a cue to their body that they're going to be abused or they're going to be vulnerable. So the goal of many, let's say, meditative practices is to be able to be safe in your body or be embodied and to experience stillness. I actually play with the word stillness because I find it a very useful projective test. And that is, you ask a person, what do they think about stillness? Do they see it as a pleasurable or a frightening experience? And for you and I, we'd say stillness is a goal in life. This is what we want, because time expands, and we can be expansive in our thinking. But for other people, stillness scares the crap out of them. It's really, in a sense, taking away the boundaries that they're using to stay alive, because their systems are so vulnerable.
We have some, that's great. And we have some other questions now. It looks like several. I don't know who.
Let's start with Max.
I am. Thank you. This has been super interesting. So I'm trying to think of how to keep my questions somewhat narrow. I'm really interested in what you're talking about super co-regulators. And I'm thinking maybe specifically what that might look like in terms of sleeping and dreaming. And if there's been any research, or if you have any ideas or theories about that, because you mentioned before that people who can't sit still always need to be doing something. Those are sort of habits created of maybe a lack of co-regulation. And often people have recurring habitual dreams of running away, being chased, violence, things like that. So on the opposite end of that spectrum, maybe an analysis of a super co-regulator's sleeping and dreaming could be.
Well, I think the answer to that. I mean, that is, it's a dream of expansiveness. It's a dream of growth. It's a dream of exploration, of discovery. So, because it's not bounded by the threats and fears. So you actually are giving very great examples, because a lot of people relive their traumas in different forms of mental experiences. Some of them are dreams, and they sometimes reoccurring dreams of trying to resolve these certain issues. So sleep patterns are really very special. And so what we would hope is that in a autonomic nervous system that is well stabilized, well regulated, sleep pattern should be much better. Because in my view, sleep quality of sleep is literally your microscope into the status of the autonomic nervous system. So it just says, is it working or not working in the way it's supposed to? And I'm wearing a Fitbit because it gives little information on sleep architecture. And if I don't get a reasonable score, I don't feel good the next morning. So it actually becomes a reinforcer, regardless of how I feel. If the numbers are good, I feel good. So we start, in a sense, evaluating certain objective measures of how we've spent our night. Because when we look at sleep architecture, we know we need a certain amount of deep sleep, and we know we need a certain amount of REM sleep. And that is where your dreams are coming in REM sleep and how they get resolved.
Yeah, thank you. Very interesting. And just one more quick thing. Have you ever considered how your theory relates to, as the mainly Buddhist concept of transmission from a teacher? So like, in terms of, I guess, passing along a understanding of a practice.
I think I can intuit from what you're saying. And what you're really asking, if you aren't an effective co-regulator, do you need words? That's really what you're saying. And the answer is, we know that words are not our primary mode of communication. You know, we communicate through our intonation of voice, our gesture, and our presence. And what you're asking is, do master teachers communicate their practice through their presence? And I would say it's a plausible explanation. I would tend to agree.
Thank you.
We might add the therapists. I mean, this is our theory of how these practices can really impact therapy without any technique.
Yeah.
Right? it's a different quality of presence.
It's a real interesting question, because when is it a practice and when is it therapy? And the issue is, if we say we're doing psychoeducational process, we're all, in a sense, safe. If we say we're doing therapy, we then have to deal with what credentials do we have to deliver that therapy, and what type of liability will we take? I totally agree. I think that if you give people tools, whether they're meditating and whether they're breathing and whether they're embodied or feeling their own body, it's going to change their health trajectory, both mental and physical health.
So we have some questions still.
We have a question from Alexa.
I'm wondering about like how intuition might play into this, and specifically in situations where, you know, say, hypothetically, I'm walking down like a dark street and I feel a sense of, oh, something's not right here. Mm-hmm. Like something in me trying to
Well, polyvagal theory actually
writes about
what you're describing. It has a construct called neuroception, where the nervous system is doing that evaluation that you're describing without a cognitive awareness. And so we're not cognitively aware of certain cues that are threatening to us, but we are always aware of our body's reaction to it. And that it has to do with that our neuroception to threat occurs much faster than we could ever interpret the cues. And this is both, I would say this is a double-edged capacity, because it means that if we get destabilized by the cues and we're sitting across from someone, we may blame them for the way we feel. And it may be something totally different. And they will start developing this narrative justifying why they're upset with us. But they may be merely responding to a disruptive sound in the environment. Maybe the air conditioning is very loud, or a plane flew overhead, or there's a, you know, the building starts to vibrate and their nervous system goes into a state of threat. And then they look at us with a glaring face. Our face drops because we're not used to being looked at that way. They see your face as being flat and evaluative of them, and they want to know why you're so upset with them. And so we create the narrative to make it fit. We have to understand that our body has certain intuitive, innate ways of detecting threat. And part of our self-education is to understand that our body will react. And it doesn't mean that someone's done it something to us.
Okay, thank you. And is there any way to like kind of discern between, you know, it, basically figuring out, is there actually a threat here, or is something in my subconscious like making this up based on maybe something that happened that I don't even remember, or that happened in a past lifetime? Like the feeling of threat is there, but right. How to discern between if it's there to for a reason, like to actually protect because there is a danger, and it just shows up because something you're not even aware of thinks that there's a danger. And I mean, this can get more and more subtle. So I'm wondering about that.
You're describing everyday life for many, many, many people. And so the exercise is, you know, again, these are exercises of not reacting too much, and in a sense, evaluating the context to try to figure out what those cues are. And sometimes the cues are associative, meaning that some experience in the past or assumed past is really cueing you. The examples that certain people feel, and I developed a music-based intervention called the Safe and Sound Protocol. And I learned from reports from providers or therapists that if they tried it with people with severe trauma histories, they got some very unusual reactions. So the music was really computer altered to send cues of safety to the body so people would feel calmer, more relaxed. But if they played that to people with severe complex trauma, that relaxation of their body was a cue of vulnerability, and they got extremely anxious and basically had to get out of there. So that's an association of a top-down of being trusting or feeling that your body is vulnerable is really now a cue of being injured. And so, but it was a very important finding because it enabled therapists then to titrate the stimulation to work through this and literally to accelerate the trauma treatment so that people could resolve this more rapidly.
Who's next? Ellen?
We have Lisa is next, and then we'll get to Ellen.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for taking my question. I have maybe a two-parter. I'm wondering if for people who've had repeated trauma, complex trauma, to the point of dissociation, does it ever prevent the evolution of the other parts of the vagal nerve? And if I have somebody who maybe it has continued traumas of various, from various sources through the years, who can come to me and maybe feels regulated in the moment, but feels dysregulated in the rest of life, how does, I guess I'm wondering, is what's enough? Like what?
Okay, so let's go back to your first question. And the first question really is, does trauma destroy literally the other aspects of the system? The answer is it doesn't destroy it, it resets it. we shift state. And this is the optimistic part of polyvagal theory. It means that these systems are there. We just have to awaken them. We have to recruit them. Better word saying, we have to convince the nervous system that it's okay for them to come out. And yeah, and this is really what therapy is with people with trauma. It's a type of seduction of their body to say, you can be safe with me. And this is the super co-regulator whose presence is sufficient for the person's defenses to feel like they don't need them. And this is linked to really the second question. And the second question is, what are your options when you have these types of situations? And the issue is, if you have a insightful, trauma-informed therapist, they will work with expanding that window. It's actually, people use the term window of tolerance, where they can have a greater range of their autonomic state. So if we translate what they're telling you, the clients, they're saying that they can't expand the range of their states they're in. They have to be defensive. And so you're really providing, through various things, whatever your practice is, whether it's yoga or dance movement therapy or breath work or even meditation, you're giving them tools to expand that window. And those tools are functionally neural exercises. And I'm going to tell you another tool. Play is a wonderful tool. Play is movement, facial expressivity, reciprocity. And part of our culture has forgotten why play is important. It's to give you resilience so you can sit down in that classroom or in front of this two-dimensional screen for hours, because your body has the resilience. And that we need to remember, our bodies need opportunities to exercise their neural circuits to be resilient.
I actually prescribe play and laughter and those sorts of practices at home. Yeah. I'm wondering, in this time of pandemic, is connection through a screen in that?
Well, I'm going.
Does that count?
Okay, I'm going to send Joe a paper I wrote for a journal, a psychiatry journal, on COVID-19 and what it basically. It's a paradoxical challenge to our nervous system, was the title, but it also has a section on using two-dimensional screens. And I, in my webinars, talk about this and say, you know, I now wear glasses when I do webinars so I can see the upper parts of people's faces so I can attend more to them. And so I had to teach myself in the webinar format to be more attentive, to be more engaged. And optimistically, I would like to see the camera in the middle of the screen and not up high. I'd like to make eye contact and not look askance at people. But the two-dimensional screen is much better than nothing. And we have to learn about how to use it. And part of what I talk about is what my father told me when you'll know how old I am with this, because in 1949, which is long before some of your parents were born, my father assembled in our living room a television set. Televisions were very rare, and he was a talented guy, so he had his soldering iron, and he put this thing together. And then he put this open chassis television with tubes and wires hanging, turned it on, and we're sitting down watching this stuff. And he says, you know, the problem will be is people will not have good manners in the future. They'll talk when other people are talking. So when television was on initially, everyone would look at the TV. Now, if a two-dimensional screen's on, we say, can I do my email? Can I look at my cell phone? Can I eat? Can I do something else? Because we've used it for education and for entertainment and not for social interaction. So we violated the principles of what our body anticipates. And so I actually enjoy doing webinars now, because that's all I do when I'm there. I don't multitask. And not multitasking is actually quite enjoyable. Not multitasking is enjoyable. And during the pandemic, this is my social life. So enjoy it. That's all.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Ellen?
Hi, everyone. And I'm really interested in this discussion. I hope I can ask my question coherently. I'm interested in taking off from what Max said around, and you mentioned neuroception, and I'm really interested in understanding using polyvagal theory to better understand Tibetan practice. And I'm really interested in trying to figure out the internal concepts of energy from a Tibetan perspective and how that fits with polyvagal theory and emotion regulation. I don't know if this makes any sense to you at all.
Well, it of course will make sense, but the only problem I have is I can't deconstruct or translate Tibetan practices. I have to know what they are from an objective level and to, in a sense, observe them. And then, yeah, I'm sure they would have polyvagal deconstructions, because anything that functions intuitively to calm us, to regulate us, to enable us to be more benevolent, more compassionate, will have a underlying neurophysiological signature that will be described by polyvagal theory. Also, it will be very intuitive. So in a sense, polyvagal theory is, in a sense, has a complexity to it. But what makes it have traction is that everything it explains is intuitive. So the way we breathe is calming. The way we interact is reassuring and trusting. Our health is based upon trusting others. And when we're in situations of uncertainty, our nervous system goes ballistic and we start getting, in a sense, disorders of our body and our mind. And the pandemic is, in a sense, contributing to that because of the uncertainty and the lack of a parental message that everything will be okay.
Yes, and Steve, I thank you, Steve. And I would just add, Ellen, I've thought about this a lot, and I have a paper that will or a couple of papers talking about about precisely this topic, because I think, well, if you look at, so Stephen, one of the things about Tibetan practice is we use visualization of faces and sort of the smiling face of the teacher or the mentor, and then the mantra as a recitation of a gentle vocal tone. And there's even practice of moving your body gently. And then all of this is coordinated with breathing.
Yeah, it's all polyvagal. It's totally.
It's all integrated into the chakra system of the nervous system, which I really feel you can directly relate to the autonomic nervous system, right? As you know, having the solar and lunar, and then having the central the reward and the central regulating channel or core of it. I don't know if you probably have had some dialogue with yogi type about the subtle body.
But really what you're talking about is top down and bottom up together. So the visualization of the protective or the close or the loved one is a top down that overrides defenses. Since remember, polyvagal theory is a hierarchical system. So if we bring visualizations of loved ones and we bring a smile, we inhibit our threat reactions. So it's probably embedded in the Tibetan Buddhist traditions, is this intuitive knowledge of the hierarchy of how our body reacts. And that leads us again, can be metaphorically organized in terms of chakra levels as well. From low levels, which are lower in the autonomic nervous system, and going down to dorsal vagal, to moving upward that are linked to the areas that are actually regulating the face and head.
Can I just interject along those lines for a second? Sorry to interrupt. And so sometimes we visualize a fierce deity where maybe it's not a smile, but it's like a, you know, expression of awe. Or even like terrific, or you know, this kind of awe. How would that fit in with this hierarchical system of the polyvagal?
you're asking whether a facial expression of enthusiasm is more powerful than a facial expression of happiness. And, you know, I can't tell you. I can just say these are positive things and they may work. I don't know. I don't know. For me, I think a warm, inviting, accessible smile would make me feel better. But, you know, someone who's exuberant and excited can also have positive attributes.
Thank you.
I don't know. But you're as long as you're on the part of the spectrum of emotion that is very positive and attractive to people, it will have a should have a positive effect.
Great.
I have a question from the chat. So if we have super co-regulators, is there such a thing as a super deregulator?
Absolutely. We have one. I don't know. I'm not going to talk politics right now. But we can tell by people's voices and their facial expressions, and some of them may be politicians, of whether or not they can co-regulate in the sense of a positive calming, or whether they're co-disruptors, which also may have a certain synergy to it. So you get everyone worked up. Maybe that gets people into fighting moods, and that's good for someone. But the issue is, it's certainly not the optimal experience of being a human. So co-regulation in my world or my model is really what we should all understand as our obligations as humans. And we should, in a sense, be in awe and honor those that are super co-regulators.
Thank you for that. We have a question from Chris.
Hi, this is very interesting. I was just curious if you can comment, and you sort of did for a moment when you talked about the idea of, I think it was neuroception, and a previous question, that this kind of feeling that there's something wrong or dangerous, and that it's sort of subcortical, and you're automatically kind of certain cues, and you know, coming from a behavior analytic perspective, you know, sounds like you're talking about respondent conditioning, and it's certain cues in the environment maybe aren't inherently dangerous, but have been paired with a traumatic event that will then elicit either a re-experiencing or of the trauma or anxiety. And that one of the things that we know is that, you know, through exposure therapies with a trusted therapist and helping a client approach some of these cues that are not, or stimuli that aren't really threatening, but they take on threatening properties because of their connection with a traumatic event. And that, you know, there's this process of habituation and sort of acclimating or unpairing the threat from these cues in the environment. And I was just wondering how your theory relates to that, or how the vagus nerve is involved in this process of habituation or.
Okay, so let's first of all say that neuroception can be cortical. It just doesn't mean it's conscious. So not all of our cortex is conscious. It's just in an area of the brain, which I'm not exactly sure where it is, but it's not in that conscious level. The issue now is, how do you decouple traumatic things? I think the decoupling would be more efficient if we can change physiological state, because I think the physiological state facilitates the coupling. So if you give a person tools in which they can regulate their physiology to be calm, that will in its own self, in its own process, start to decouple. It was always my, in a sense, intuitive intention that trauma could be treated if it became an event without a visceral association. And in a way, that is really how people are, in a sense, resolving trauma. Because frequently, the events that may be the triggers, let me put it this way, some people are, the traumatic event may not be as traumatic. For some people, of course, it's really a horrible bit. But for some people, it may be like being embarrassed in public can be a life-changing event for them. And because they were embarrassed at a specific time in their life when they were very vulnerable. And now anything that is associated with that can actually start to trigger those feelings. And often the triggers, those feelings that are triggered may be more intense than actually what the event was. And I think that if we can, in a sense, shift the state and then re-experience by being in a different state, then it gets decoupled. I think this is pretty close to the principles underlying somatic experiencing therapies. So that's Peter Levine's work. But it really is somatic experiencing, which really, you know, you shift it from a visceral to now something that's outside your bodily feelings. But always, always honoring your bodily feelings, not trying to deny them or numb the body. In a sense, we have to say, these are feelings, I feel that, I honor those feelings. They're not adaptive for what I'm doing now, but they may have been very important in my survival then. So we start to have respect for our body's response and not angry at our body.
Yeah, and that may be a part of the, you know, I'm not sure, Chris, if you're familiar, you know, I'm sure, Stephen, you're aware of the work that Emma Sapal did and others have done with intensive yogic breath work in PTSD. But I think that that kind of intensive breath work, when you're working both the upper and the lower branches of the vagal nerve, probably is that's probably how it works.
Well, the breath work, and she also worked with Pat Gerberg and Richard Brown, and they use not just, you know, calming breath, but they use energetic breathing as well. And if you can then, in a sense, have that whole repertoire, then you can move through all those states of the autonomic nervous system under your control, and that creates resilience. So it makes a lot of sense that that type of work can be extraordinarily helpful.
Thank you.
We have a question from Nina.
Oh, good evening, everyone. I just had a quick thought about if ADHD in children can be mistaken or misdiagnosed for trauma. And if so, how might the medication for ADHD affect children with trauma?
That's a great question. So there's a pediatrician, Burke. She's now the Surgeon General or whatever of the state of California, but she had done a lot of work on ACEs, adverse childhood experiences. And we were both speakers at a conference on foster children. And she was talking on ADHD, and her talk was to me startling, because what she was saying is that the high prevalence of abuse and neglect in children who express ADHD. So it's not that trauma is interpreted as, it's not that ADHD is interpreted as trauma, but trauma can affect the nervous system and have a features of ADHD. It doesn't mean that that accounts for all of them. It's just saying that there's a higher frequency of adverse childhood experiences. But if you objectively look at ADHD and you say, what physiological state are these children in, or adults? Their bodies are in states of mobilization and mobilization for defense. So they're, in a sense, autonomically more in a sympathetic nervous system, and they're less able to calm and self-regulate. And also not necessarily able to co-regulate. And again, we go through this whole question in our society. It's all about self-regulation and intentionality. But self-regulation requires a history of co-regulation. And if a child doesn't have a safe home, those experiences of being safe and trusting, enabling co-regulation to occur, don't create a basis for self-regulation.
Yes, thank you, Stephen. I had Well, I had another question. Mary Elise, do you want to say something? Okay. I had a question that sort of related to your comment about, you know, Brown and Dick Brown's work and Patricia Gerbar's work about the whole intensive yogic breathing process, because my feeling has always been that the sort of mixed autonomic arousal that comes with this kind of work, where you get a sort of arousal that's euphoric or euthymic, and then you have the deep calm of the autonomic, of the parasympathetic arousal, is that this is an interesting model for flow states or flow experience. I'm sure you've thought about this, so I'm just curious where you are, what your thoughts about the relationship between this kind of autonomic arousal, unique or mixed autonomic arousal and flow.
It's mixes. I think of it more in terms of expanding the window of tolerance, the range in which a person can function. And once you give people tools that enable them to experience their body, there's a different level of embodiment. And there's, in a sense, a greater ability to move their body across or through these different states. And so whether we talk about flowing from one to the other, or the concept of flow, where we fit within society and whatever is demanded of us, it's really our body reading cues of the environment and the nervous system adapting to that in the most appropriate way. So when your body has a greater range, a greater repertoire, then you can fit in better. You can solve those problems more rapidly without the body resorting to states of defense.
Okay, so any last questions? We have just a few minutes left, and yes, Esme has a question.
Thank you. This discussion has been fantastic as far as what does this mean on an individual basis? So two people or perhaps a small group of people. And I'm wondering at a societal level, the impact or the responsibility, what responsibility do we have to each other to create a space for safety? I don't even know how to articulate.
I know what. I can actually give you your words if you like. You want to give voice to people. And in a way, when we are open and understanding and co-regulators, we give voice to others. And this is really the issue of social justice of society. The real issue is people are not being heard, or their bodies are telling them they're not being heard. And a nervous system that doesn't have a voice is a nervous system in a state of defense. And that is our responsibility to, in a sense, change or support society in a way that people have their voice. Joe, I'd like to, can you put up the slides and I'll just go through them, because they can really be summary concepts of what we've gone over.
Great. I think these are they.
Okay. There it is. So if I'm asked the simple question, what is the clinical impact of polyvagal theory? It really has emphasis on our responses and not on events. So the theory transforms our personal narrative from a documentary emphasizing events and objects to emphasizing our pragmatic quest to be safe with the implicit bodily drive to survive. And that bodily drive is expressed in our bodily feelings. So it becomes an emphasis on feelings and not on events and objects. And I contrast this with ACEs, or adverse childhood experiences, which is really measures with inventories, or at least spreadsheets, of events that are negative, but not providing any questions regarding the individual's response. So can you move it to the next one, please? So, yeah, go back one. Yeah. So this is the thought slide for the day. And that is, what if Descartes were mistranslated and he really didn't say je pense donc je suis, I think therefore I am, but he said je me sens donc je suis, I feel myself therefore I am. And if you notice in the French, I use the reflexive form of the verb, which is to feel oneself, because in English we don't differentiate the word feel from feeling an object versus feeling internally. In French, we can say it this way, but what would the world be like if the dualism was about, I feel my body? That's what makes, that is what life is about. I am embodied. So where would we be today in terms of how we treat ourselves and how we treat others? Now, next slide. So the theory provides a theoretical basis for a neuroscience of safety and explains how safety promotes spontaneous social engagement behaviors and health, growth, and respiration. What it really means is that social behavior and physical health are the same system. So we can't say it's all in your head or it's all in those behaviors. And I go to the doctor, he fixed my physical world. It's all one nervous system. And the way we engage others is also the way our nervous system engages its organs. So the polyvagal theory provides insights for neurophysiologically based therapeutic strategies. And the therapeutic strategy is safety is the treatment. Whatever we do to enable that our nervous systems interpret the world as safe will lead to better outcomes. And safety is not the same thing as removing threat. Our body needs, threat's not great. I'm not saying threat is something we should minimize. We should minimize threat, but it's not sufficient. Our body needs cues of safety. And cues of safety we've been talking about are intonation of voice, proximity, gesture, facial expressivity, or let's go back to, I think it was Max's point, the transmission of the master by the presence. So co-regulation is really this transmission of a state of safety from one to another. And the last slide is, with polyvagal theory, basically there's a new vocabulary that you need to master to understand human behavior and from a polyvagal perspective. And we've gone through actually many of these tonight in a very conversational way. One was the autonomic nervous system changed during evolution. The system functions in a hierarchical manner, paralleling evolution, meaning our newer circuits inhibit older ones. And when we are challenged, we shift state consistent with evolution in reverse, and this is called dissolution. Our social engagement system links the muscles of the face and head with the vagal regulation of the heart, and that enables us to calm down with the vagal break and inhibit sympathetic activity. Reciprocity, co-regulation, connectedness, that's our biological imperative as a species. That's what we need and that's what we crave. Trauma retunes the autonomic nervous system, compromising the ability to feel safe enough to connect with others. And it's really, as I said, really enlightening to interact with people who are on a journey of healing, who have experienced severe trauma, because their goal in life is to be able to co-regulate with another, to feel safe enough to be able to be hugged, to feel good with another person near them. We discussed neuroception. I also mentioned the one nervous system model, this notion of a brain nervous system distinct or central nervous system distinct from the nervous system of the autonomic organs is just faulty because we have one integrated nervous system. A scientist by the name of Walter Hess got the Nobel Prize in 1949. Basically making the point that all these systems are interrelated and that the older or lower ones, meaning in the body, influence the higher ones. So there was this bidirectional communication. And basically this model is not taught in medical schools or in graduate school. Autonomic state is an intervening variable, meaning that if we can look at people, listen to their voice, measure their autonomic state, we can literally tell you what their other symptoms are going to be. in terms of comorbidities. And with this knowledge, we realize that we can intervene in individuals by therapies targeted at that intervening variable. And the work that you're doing in Atlanta has a lot to do with going in on that level through breath, through meditation, and even through top-down thought processes where you are learning different models of what it is to be a human being. So we covered a lot of it today.
Very exciting. Hold on just one second. Let me stop the sharing. And yes, we did. Thank you. And we all in the pleasure of seeing you and dialoguing. And I really appreciate everyone's active participation, great questions, and pulling forth your wisdom, Stephen. And we're just really grateful to you for joining us for this evening.
Well, thank you for inviting me into all your homes. And thank you for allowing me to experience challenges with good questions in a novel environment and to challenge my social engagement system. So thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Stephen. And thank you, everyone, for the great questions.
Yeah.
Great reflections and sharing.
Good night, everyone. Please enjoy. Have a safe and good night.
And the conversation continues, right, Joe?
The conversation continues.